Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome to Madison's Notes, the official podcast of Princeton University's James Madison Program in American Ideals and Institutions. I'm your host, Annika Nordquist. This week's guest is Professor W. Brad Wilcox, who's a professor of sociology at the University of Virginia, where he also directs the National Marriage Project. In addition, he's a Future of Freedom Fellow at the Institute for Family Studies and a non-resident senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. Today, we're here to talk about his new book, a cause near and dear to my heart. It's called Get Married: Why Americans Should Defy the Elite, Forge Strong Families, and Save Civilization. There's so much discussion of marriage and dating and having kids in today's public discourse, but very few people who have Dr. Wilcox's ability to really delve deep into the data about why to get married, when to get married, and what marriage does for society. I hope you find this conversation both theoretically interesting and practically useful, as I know I certainly did. So with no further ado, I hope you enjoy. Dr. Wilcox, welcome to the show. It is a real delight to have you on.
Thanks, Annika. It's great to be here with you.
Yeah, and I gotta say, this is such a full circle moment for me because when I was in college, my college pastor used to send your work around all the time. So it's very exciting for me to be able to chat with you now.
Yep, great. That's hysterical.
So to kick us off, and I am currently engaged, full disclosure, so playing a little bit of devil's advocate here, but right now you've written this book, Marriage is going to fix all your problems. Marriage is going to make you happy. It's going to make you richer. It's going to save civilization is in the subtitle.
Right.
And yet 40% of marriages-ish right now end in divorce. So if marriage really does all these amazing things, what is it that 40% of people are missing out on?
Yes, that's a great question. So I think what we're seeing is that we still have, you know, many cultural currents that are coursing through our culture that are pushing young adults and middle-aged adults, obviously, and not to mention the boomers who are still divorcing in record numbers.
Still, they're not done yet.
And they're not done divorcing. They're, you know, they've got to keep up their reputation. But seriously, right? So I think, you know, there are, and I'm not saying that every marriage should go the distance. Clearly, when there are cases, you know, involving things like, for instance, domestic violence or, you know, drug abuse or, you know, serial infidelity, these are all cases where, you know, marriages shouldn't go the distance. But, you know, there are a lot of factors, you know, in the culture today that are pushing people in kind of in a more what I call me first direction in the book. And they don't recognize and don't realize that when you kind of live for yourself in marriage, it often ends in disaster. When you kind of, when you don't kind of embrace the all-in mentality that we see, you know, classically linked to marriage, you're also more likely to fail as well. When you don't kind of recognize that, you know, every relationship that's kind of important and meaningful tends to have difficult days, weeks, chapters, you know, you're likely to land in a bad spot as well. So I think part of the challenge today is that, you know, too many Americans don't recognize and realize that embracing a family-first mindset where you're trying to put your spouse and your kids' well-being, you know, ahead of your own, recognizing the importance of kind of working through conflicts constructively, recognizing that there is something to be said about, you know, marital permanence. You know, there's something to be said, too, about fidelity, you know, not embracing every new option that might come down, you know, the road or nowadays, some internet portal, you know, that it's these sort of classic values and virtues that will sustain a strong civil marriage. And it's the kinds of people who are steering clear of a lot of the bad advice we're getting from our elites. They're more likely to find themselves stably and happily married.
Mm. So because you're a quant guy, I feel empowered to ask, do we actually have any sense of how many marriages are actually ending kind of for ideological reasons, like the ones that you're laying out versus the reasons that people more traditionally think of as leading to divorce?
Well, what we do see in the research is that there is no group of Americans who are more stably married. I'm thinking you're, and I, you know, began in the introduction talking about this When it comes to parents, who obviously in some ways are the most important group, you know, because our kids are more likely to flourish with stably married parents, the most stably married Americans are Americans who are college educated and conservative, right? So that's a fact. My colleague and friend, Richard Reeves, has sort of talked about, you know, well, college educated Americans are doing so well because they're kind of, you know, they're a little bit more liberal on social issues, and they kind of are, you know, pragmatic and prudential about marriage today, living kid-centered lives. What Richard doesn't appreciate, though, is that when you, again, when you break out the college-educated set by the conservative, who are a minority, obviously, in that world, versus the liberals, you know, in that world, the conservatives are winning hands down in terms of both happiness, marital quality, and marital stability.
There's a lot of common misconceptions in the discourse that I'm going to kind of, it's maybe going to be a bit of a laundry list, but we'll try to work through it. But I mean, one maybe confounding factor that I'd be curious if you have any insight on is people who go to college marry later, usually after they finish college. And I mean, most people are quite adamant that that's the responsible thing to do, to kind of wait to get married. I mean, most people would even say right out of college is too young. You know, you should wait until you're more settled in your career and what have you. Is that true? Or to what extent is that true?
So it is true that when it comes to marital stability, kind of for the average person, kind of getting married in your late 20s or early 30s is associated with the most marital stability. So that's, and that sort of like dovetails with that kind of elite wisdom, right? But there are at least two exceptions that I've identified or that colleagues have identified. So some colleagues have looked at couples who are attending religious services together. And for them, kind of getting married in their 20s, you know, broadly defined, is, you know, no extra risk for divorce for them. And then Lyman Stone and I, Lyman is a PhD in demography at McGill, we found in our research that getting directly married in your, you know, mid-20s, roughly defined, without cohabiting first, is linked to comparatively low risks of divorce. So I think it's just important to recognize and realize here, Annika, that if you're kind of generating a kind of a complex relationship history with lots of different configurations and partners and cohabiting situations, then for whatever reason, maybe kind of waiting until you're around 28, 29, 30, 31 might be the best strategy. But if you kind of either are religious or kind of just really, you know, devoted to your boyfriend or girlfriend, and, you know, you're not accumulating some kind of complicated relationship history, it looks like getting married in your mid-20s is not a risk factor for divorce. And the other piece of that no one in this world knows about, though, is that the most happily married people are folks who get married in their mid-20s.
Oh, interesting.
And I think there the story, right, is that you can get started more quickly on the business of getting married and having a family, and you're establishing common, you know, routines, traditions, vacations, you're kind of planning your life together. You have more kids, you're more likely to be on the same page ideologically and religiously, because, you know, often I think you're probably picking someone maybe where you're not, I think like the longer you wait to marry someone, the more likely you are to just to pick kind of someone who's available rather than like true love, so to speak, you know? So I think that's part of what's happening here too. But anyways, the story for marital stability and marital quality is a little bit different. And if you're thinking just about marital quality, you definitely get married in your mid-20s. If you're worried about stability and you're just the generic person, yeah, you could wait a little bit. But the final thing that I would say too is we are seeing just an incredible surge in young adults like yourself who are basically projecting are never going to marry and never have children. So Lyman Stone is projecting, and I'm projecting, that about 1 in 3 young adults today will never marry. And that's record demographic territory. And so my view is that if you meet someone who's really a great person, you know, and there's a great friendship in college, there is nothing that should stop you from getting married to that person, you know, early 20s, mid-20s, whatever. But you can't assume that they're just going to be waiting for you when you hit, you know, 28, basically.
Oh, I have so many questions based on that. But I appreciate what you said about, you know, people who wait for 30, because I recently had a conversation with another young woman who, I mean, because I'm more religious, a lot of my friends have gotten married very young. And she was like, well, if you're getting married at 22, does that mean that you just want to get married and you pick someone? And I'm like, I mean, if you're getting married at 28, especially, I guess that kind of leads into the next question, but especially if you're a girl, it's quite likely that you'll freak out and take whatever option you have. But I mean, that is also something that is, I mean, I wouldn't even say it's really in the discourse because it's super controversial. There's sort of a far right-wing discourse that really emphasizes biological differences between men and women and leans into marrying younger women. And then there's a far left discourse that really, really does not want to talk about it. Don Lemon, I think, made a comment about there being such a thing as a woman's prime and had to apologize. And it was a whole thing. Between kind of those two extremes,
sure.
What's your view on how should men and women be thinking about when to marry differently?
Yeah, I mean, I do think that men are less mature than women. You know, it takes us just longer to mature physically and I think emotionally in many cases. So I think it makes sense that couples would marry roughly the same age, or as my wife and I did, we were both fourth years at the University of Virginia. We met in the spring of our senior year and, you know, dated for a couple of years and got married and we're just a few months apart. Or when the guy's, you know, somewhat older than the woman, and you know he's just had a chance to mature, you know, and figure out his identity a little bit, and you know is sort of forging his way in the world, and is capable of commitment, and you know, and is ready to be a reliable husband. So I would sort of say, broadly speaking, that, you know, we would expect that couples who are roughly the same age or couples where he is a bit older are ones that are going to be more likely to flourish, just sort of given the dynamics that, you know, take place in terms of how men develop versus how women develop. And then also, I think, too, women do tend to prefer to marry men who are either roughly the same status as they are or have some kind of higher status than they do as well. And, you know, given the broader dynamics that are playing out in higher education and the workforce, obviously, today, we see that a lot of women are outperforming the men in their social world. And so, you know, it's harder for them to realize that, you know, older, more traditional pattern. But I still think that when you look at kind of who's getting married, you do see plenty of evidence indicating that women, you know, tend to prefer guys who are doing well when it comes to either education or work or some other kind of important socially valued, you know, domain.
Mm. I mean, it is interesting because, I mean, you open your book with Andrew Tate, which was a very bold choice. I mean, going against Andrew Tate for the listeners,
sure, right,
everyone calm down. But it does seem like that kind of attitude does play into, I don't know, at least kind of in that corner, some kind of masculine fear that women will somehow, you know, whatever, sap away kind of accumulated wealth for men. Is that true?
Well, obviously, divorce is a problem, and when divorce happens, men often lose big financially,
right.
You know, and that's a real concern that, you know, that many young men have about marriage today. But it's important just to sort of acknowledge that most marriages go the distance today, as we, you know, just touched on. And so for the average guy who gets and stayed married, he's just in a much better financial position throughout the life course than he would be had he not married. So we know that, you know, basically stably married guys have about 10 times the assets in their 50s as they get closer to retirement compared to never married men. Now, part of that's a selection effect, right? But there's just no question that men who get married work harder, they work more strategically, they're less likely to be fired. And couples who are married are more likely to be prudential in how they spend their money. They're more likely to accumulate a major asset in the form of a house and a 401k, you know, portfolio that kind of are going to put them into a relatively better position, you know, as they move towards retirement. It's important, too, that there was this story in Bloomberg that said that women who stay single and don't have kids are getting richer, kind of implying that women who steer clear of marriage and motherhood are in a better financial position than women who get married and have kids. And what the article neglected was actually any data on married women was just astonishing. It was completely, you know, fouled up on Bloomberg's part. But we know too that married women have more than 10 times the assets, you know, compared to their never married female peers on average. So for the average person, you know, marriage really does boost your financial well-being too. And that's an important point, as you kind of, just to be honest, as you kind of like, you know, think about, you know, the realities of life. And there's still an Austinian, as in Jane Austen, you know, kind of, you know, reality out there that people don't always want to talk about. But it's true that, you know, if you get married and stay married to a reasonably good person, you're going to be in a way better financial position than if you never marry, or if you marry someone who's not a good fit or a good match, or, you know, of high character, and end up getting divorced, obviously.
Yeah. The money question is so, I mean, it's strange because I feel like in my lifetime, I've watched the public discourse go from, oh, it's not about money, to it's all about money. I mean, you call this, you've called this in interviews and in your work, the Midas mindset. How much should that actually affect the way we think about marriage?
I mean, I think kind of, that's a great question. I think that we should attach some significance to money in terms of thinking about a spouse and thinking about marriage, you know, more generally, but not, you know, ultimate significance to money. And so what I would say is that kind of attaching too much importance to money gets you in trouble, and it leads you to invest too much in, you know, your career or in just money-making strategies and often consumption patterns that are going to make you and your spouse and your kids miserable. At the same time, I do see that couples, both personally and in the data, where the husbands are not reliable breadwinners, are more likely to land in real trouble. What's striking is that, you know, there's research from Sasha Kellerwald at Harvard in sociology telling us that when the wife loses her job, there's no effect on marital stability. When the husband loses his job, a 33% increase in the risk of divorce. This is a big difference between husbands and wives and marriage and work. So it's still the case in 2024, Annika, that often implicitly, right, not explicitly, but implicitly, husbands and wives attach more importance to his stable work than they do to hers. It's particularly true when there are children in the picture. And so I think we would kind of help ourselves to sort of do more to encourage people to be cognizant of that reality. And one reason I think that, and ironically, I was criticized in the New York Times, you know, as a scold by a progressive journalist. And she said that, you know, well, there aren't enough marriageable men out there. Why are you encouraging us to get married, given the fact that we're not finding enough men out there who are worthy of marriage? And I think what she doesn't appreciate, though, is that if you don't put marriage on men's front burner, right, on their radar screen, there, many men are not going to rise to the occasion to be marriageable, right? So in other words, if you kind of like basically exclude marriage from men's thinking, or you put, you know, put it down to age 30 or 35, right, then for a lot of guys in their teens and 20s, they're just not going to be all that intentional about education or work, right? And then ironically, they're not going to be as attractive as potential boyfriends and husbands. And then you're going to complain about the lack of marriageable men, right? So it's, we have to realize that money does matter to some extent, and that we should do a better job, particularly of preparing our young men for marriage and for a vocation that would make them, you know, a reliable breadwinner and therefore a more attractive boyfriend and husband as well.
I mean, our culture focuses a lot on, you know, career, career and money. And I think at least part of the reason why people focus on that at the expense of marriage is that there's this very, I mean, I'll just be frank. A lot of this is also the perception I was raised with, that you can really prepare for your education and for your career, and you can't really prepare yourself to meet the one. Or maybe you can prepare in some sort of vague way, but so much of it is up to chance that there's not really anything that you can do to control it. So you should just sort of forget about it until it happens to you. Is that true?
No, not at all. I think people are, you know, we're kidding ourselves, right? So I think we have to realize, you know, that number one, people who meet one another in in-person contexts are more likely to be happily married than folks who meet on the internet, or actually also in one context, in a bar or tavern, based on work done by my colleague, Dr. Wendy Wang. Now, is this causal? Who knows?
Sorry, bar or tavern is in the same category as internet?
Yes, right.
Oh, so interesting.
What she found was that couples who got married, sorry, who met their spouse either in a religious context, church or some kind of religious event, or at a, like a social event, like, you know, like a friend's party, right?
Right.
Or at work or in college, right? were more likely to be flourishing. Now, and again, this can be a selection effect. Whereas folks who met their spouse on the internet or at a bar or tavern were not doing so well. Hmm. But it just suggests to us that I think trying to kind of, you know, make the effort to socialize in person, meet people in a wide range of contexts in person, you know, will maximize your chances. And then, you know, having the courage to ask someone out on a date or to be willing to say yes to a date. I mean, I can't tell you how many people kind of tell us stories about how their wife was initially kind of, you know, a little bit hesitant to go on that first date or the second date, you know, and had to be sort of won over, you know, but now are happily married. People like Arthur Brooks, you know, who's at Harvard's business school, kind of tells that story. And there are plenty of cases like his, where he had to kind of convince his wife, Esther, when they were initially dating, that this was all going to, you know, work out well. I mean, I think encouraging adults to be a lot more persistent than they are about, you know, giving dating a chance, meeting a wide range of people, and getting off their phones and doing more in-person things. That's so important. But then even thinking too about their, you know, where they land in their 20s for work, right? No one talks about this, but, you know, Joe Price is an economist at BYU. Dan Lichter, I think his colleague for this paper, is an economist a social scientist at Cornell. Then I think maybe one other person did this paper looking at kind of marriageable men, marriageable women ratios in different parts of the country. And just find there are some places where it's really hard, I mean, just numbers wise, for young women to meet young men of their, you know, educational, you know, sort of status. I think New York City is one place where it's hard for young women who are well-educated to meet young men who are, you know, in their same position, right?
That checks with what I've seen from people my age.
numbers wise. Yeah. And there are other places where there are more young men than there are young women who would be eligible for marriage. So like, this is, you know, not news people necessarily want to hear, but, you know, if you're thinking about marriage as an important life goal and you're not dating anyone, you may want to think about, you know, your next career, you know, step in terms of, you know, are there going to be, you know, do I know that there's a group of young men or young women out there who would be, you know, eligible to marry and, you know, interested in marriage? Or is this the kind of like city or community context where people are not very interested in marriage, or there aren't that many women or men, you know, who might be eligible for marriage? So that's certainly the kind of thing that, and we do see in terms of like the empirical evidence here that young adults who are religious, for instance, and young adults who are conservative, for instance, are more likely to be getting married than their peers who are secular and their peers who are progressive. And so that tells us it's not just sort of this random thing where you just magically find someone who kind of, you know, is a good fit, that there are cultural and other currents that shape your odds of finding someone. And that if you're looking to get married, you should be attentive to those currents and steer your life in the direction that's going to put you in a better place to meet a mate.
Would that even be true for conservative men, given that there are so many more conservative men than women?
So I've looked at women who, in terms of this, at the end of my book, I look at both conservative women and religious women and find that they're more likely to be married in their 18 to 40 bracket. I'd have to go back and look at the data for the men.
Yeah.
So, yep.
Is there an element of, I mean, personal habit forgetting kind of the social element, but in terms of personal habits that people should cultivate? Because it does seem there's sort of a romance novel picture of, I'll find the person who completes me and our flaws will somehow cancel out and that will, you know, that will be my soulmate. Is that true, or are there ways in which people should be cultivating personal habits that can make them happier in marriage?
Yeah, I do think that, you know, focusing on dressing well, on staying physically fit, on having a clear kind of mission in life are things that women and men should be paying more attention to. And in my book, you know, in my chapter on gender, I specifically talk about the ways in which women are more likely to be attracted to men who are physically strong, who are more protective, who are deemed to be more reliable breadwinners, you know. And so unfortunately, we know that a lot of young men today in a culture that often distracts them with, you know, gaming devices and doesn't really kind of challenge them in school and hold up a constructive model of masculinity for them as they move through adolescence and into young adulthood, is giving us a world where too many young men are floundering, you know, and this is, I'm getting this from both liberal women and conservative women saying the same thing, you know, they're complaining about the quality of men. And so I do think we need to keep encouraging our teenage boys and young men to be more intentional about, you know, everything from physical fitness to their education to their vocational path. Now, I'm not saying to move in a, you know, a workist direction or in the Midas mindset. You know, I'm not saying that, you know, and some, obviously some young men are too work oriented and some young women are too work oriented. But, you know, there are unfortunately plenty of young men too seem to have really no clear direction when it comes to their schooling and work. And it's those men who are not particularly attractive as potential husbands.
Hmm. What about, I mean, you mentioned way back with the first question, you mentioned fidelity. And that also seems culturally, I mean, I think it's fairly common sense that a marriage in which someone's unfaithful is less stable. But in leading up to marriage, there is really an emphasis on, oh, you know, you should date as many people as possible. Is that bad advice?
So obviously fidelity is hugely important when it comes to forging a strong and stable marriage. And what we do see is that both for men and women, or for women and men, that young adults who've had a lot of relationships and a lot of cohabiting partners are more likely to end up divorced and they're more likely to end up unhappily married. And this is weird, right? Because for most things in life, Annika, like more experience is a good thing. Yeah. Like the more experience you have teaching a class or playing tennis or football or whatever it might be, playing the piano, you generally become a better, you know, practitioner of that craft or that sport. When it comes to love and marriage, people who have a lot of experience with a lot of partners do worse. And I think there are probably two, we don't know exactly why. I think I've got two theories. One is it's kind of a critical comparison. So like if I've, you know, lived with John and Hal and Larry, but I'm married to Adam, like Adam may not measure up. He may be a good guy, but he's not as like, you know, ambitious as the first partner. He's not as funny as the second partner. And he's, you know, not as emotionally in tune with me as my third partner. And he's like overall, like, you know, a good guy and my husband, I love him. But there could be a way in which like lots of other experiences with like serious relationships could, you know, negatively color how you look at your spouse, right? That's one theory. And the other theory I think that's relevant here is just that you've had experience breaking up from serious relationships. And so when things have gone south, you know what it means to like leave the relationship and start anew. And so probably divorce is less likely to be, you know, out of your thinking than it would be for someone who's just kind of, you know. So and I'm not saying you marry the first person you meet either, right? I'm just saying that you, the strategy here is you kind of move slowly, both physically and emotionally when it comes to people and test the waters. And if you seem like there's a basis for a good friendship, you know, and there's a real attraction there, then, and it's mutual, there's mutual, I mean, and these things often take time too, right? But if you kind of reach the point where with someone, like there's this, you know, this deep and abiding friendship, mutual love and admiration and respect, then you get engaged and get married. But if at some point in that process, you have the sense that this is not a good fit or this person's not as attracted to you as you are to them, then that's when you begin to, you know, break things off and look for someone else.
Yeah, it's funny. I saw an article, I think on Facebook a few months ago, where they had, you know, some study found that if you have had fewer sexual partners, you're more sexually satisfied when you're married.
Correct.
And I have never seen vitriol like I saw in that comment section. People were upset. And a lot of what they were saying was, I guess, the negative spin on what you just said. It's like, oh, if you don't have any standard of comparison, of course you'll be happy with anything. But it was interesting the level of emotion that it brought out of like average people on Facebook.
Right. No, I mean, it's, I mean, obviously most people today have more than one partner heading into marriage. And so, you know, we have, it's a very different culture than it was, you know, in some bygone era. You know, so that's just the reality. But I'm just saying, like, if you can kind of minimize your experiences heading into marriage, it looks like that's for most of us a good thing.
I mean, there's a stereotype, I think, among men, again, especially this sort of very online type of man, that women like only care about money. And among women, the attitude is, you know, men only really care about looks and maybe youth to some extent. Is that true? Are people actually kind of be more holistic about factors, or is that sort of more cynical take on what men and women are really after true?
I think that looks and money are important for kind of the initial stage of courtship, but I don't think that they are, you know, the be all and end all, right? So I think that's the, you know, it's important to, you know, basically just, you know, acknowledge and appreciate that, you know, that looks and financial prospects are, you know, part of the picture, but not the only picture. And obviously throughout time and space, you know, couples with a wide range of, you know, physical and financial resources, you know, or endowments, you know, have, you know, gotten together and married and had families. And so I'm looking for a world where, you know, a wide range of different kinds of people can, you know, forge a way to connect and date and mate and marry.
So I'm interested to move into, you say a lot of pretty interesting stuff about the political implications in your book, and especially talking about class differences. But just to kind of kick off this portion of the conversation, you call out the elites in the title of your book, which was really kind of coming out guns blazing. What leads you to label this as specifically an elite phenomenon? Because I think in responses, this is one of the things that really seems to bother people, that you're pinning it specifically on kind of elite messaging.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of funny. One of the first journalists to object to my framing of the book's subtitle when the book was released on Twitter in the fall was himself a starring figure in the book. As someone who kind of had published a piece in Vox kind of saying that the decline of marriage is not a problem, right? So, you know, the irony here is, and of course the rejoinder here is that elites are saying, well, us elites are doing things great as, you know, when it comes to marriage. Why are you, you know, saying defy the elites? Well, my point is not what you're practicing, it's what you're preaching or not preaching, right? Is the whole point of my book on that score. And I'm saying that too many of elites talk left and walk right when it comes to marriage. In their own lives, they're often leading very marriage-centered lives. Good husbands, good wives, good parents, you know, great, you know, good for you. But when it comes to their roles, their professional and public roles as journalists or professors or school superintendents or C-suite executives or Hollywood moguls, they're often not doing anything to underline the value and importance of marriage. They're not producing TV shows or movies. They're not kind of incorporating curricula into their public high schools. They're not, you know, writing accurate articles in Vox that tell us the truth about marriage and family. So I'm not looking for, you know, some kind of treacly rose-colored thing. I'm just looking for the truth. And the truth is that on average, kids and adults and communities are more likely to be flourishing when stable marriage anchors their lives. And that message is not being told enough or fairly in too many elite cultural platforms.
Well, I also think Americans hate considering themselves to be elite or allied with elite. And I wonder if that's that word kind of upsets people for that reason.
Yeah, I'm sure it does. But again, I'm, you know, I would like to see a world where, you know, our cultural leaders would be more cognizant of their authority and influence when it comes to marriage and family, and do a better job of just, again, communicating the truth. And that is that kids are more likely to flourish when they have the benefit of married parents. And that's true also for adults too. And when they put a ring on it, you know, on average.
So talk a little bit about the class differences here, and especially, I mean, this is another difficult topic. People do not like talking about class, but we're going to do it anyway. But I think in some ways it's kind of surprising that, you know, the college educated group is actually doing pretty okay when it comes to marriage, and that working class families, who I think are still more religious in America, less so. So why is it that this kind of this ideology is having such a disparate impact?
So talk about four groups of Americans who are succeeding at marriage today. And part of that's a class story. And that's what a lot of elites know about. They know that more educated, more affluent Americans are more likely to be getting married and staying married. So a majority of college-educated Americans are married today, 1855. Only minority of less educated Americans are married today. That's one example. But what most elites don't realize is that the same thing is true for religion, Asian Americans, and for conservatives. So a majority of religious Americans in that bracket are married. Only a minority of secular Americans in that bracket are married. A majority of Asian Americans, and depends on the survey, whites are married, and only a minority of Hispanics and African Americans are married. And then a majority of conservatives are married, and only a minority of liberals and moderates are married. So what we can see from this story is that both, in a sense, class and culture matter. And when it comes to class, I think part of the story here is that working class and poor couples are more likely to have men who are not stably employed full time in their communities. And it's still the case again in 2024 that women prefer to marry guys and to stay married to guys who are reliable breadwinners. Again, I'm not saying women can't work. I'm just saying that women who, including working women, prefer to have a husband who is, you know, can be counted on to have a job. And that's, I think, partly just a kind of like a sign that he's got his stuff together and he's just sort of like, you know, a decent guy. He's the kind of guy who can hold down a full-time job. But it's just interesting that there's more, you know, I think practical and symbolic value attached to his stable breadwinning, you know, for couples than hers.
Interesting. Yeah. I mean, that was also one fact that really stuck out to me from the book when you said that matriarchal households, which are, I mean, so theoretically popular among the elite, are so much more common among the working class. That was, yeah, really sad, actually.
So I talk about breadwinner moms, and there's, you know, been a lot of reporting and research on breadwinner moms, and it's often held to be a, you know, a great thing. But what's not told is it often involves either a single mom or a situation where the mom is doing more work financially and practically, you know, in, you know, all domains of life, and the husband or the boyfriend is, you know, not working as much outside the home and is more likely to be wasting time, you know, or whatever, spending time, you know, watching TV or playing Xbox, et cetera, while she is doing more to clean and cook and all that stuff. So as this thing kind of actually works its way out into the real world, it's more common for working class and poor communities and is for upper middle class communities. It is often the source of tension and conflict for these working class and poor couples that I spoke with.
It does. I mean, you gave some pretty interesting examples of ways in which our tax code, among other things, but actual policies penalize marriage for the working class. This was quite frightening to read, but could you comment a little bit on that?
Sure. So one of the things that was striking to me about interviews and just ordinary life here in Charlottesville, in fact, I was having an event at a restaurant in town not too long ago on marriage. And after the event was over, the waitress approached me and was talking to me. And she said, oh, well, you know, me and my husband, I think it's air quotes, and he works here in the restaurant too. He's a cook and I'm a waitress. And we've got two kids. We're actually not legally married because I'm on Medicaid and my two kids are on Medicaid. And so we know that if we were to get married and report our, you know, our whole income, then I would lose access to Medicaid and our girls would. And I'd interviewed another couple with two kids in Virginia with the same exact scenario, you know, for the book. And we see with the research too, that, you know, about 10% of, you know, young adults who are not married in the lower half of the income ladder are saying that one reason that's the case is because they're concerned about losing government benefits, right? So this is a real thing, and it's just a consequence of the way in which our immune system programs are set up. It's complicated, but just the bottom line here is, unfortunately, programs like Medicaid and food stamps often penalize marriage for working class couples with children, and we should address this penalty in Washington with legislation.
Yeah, the financial portion of it, especially when it comes to kids, is really interesting to me. A lot of countries have pronatalist, you know, policies surrounding trying to make it cheaper to have kids. But at the end of the day, I mean, having kids, just even if you stay married, having kids just sort of is expensive. I mean, to what extent do you think people who choose not to have kids, it's because of more ideological reasons versus just sort of financial reality?
So I think that's certainly part and parcel of what's happening. We do see, I think, in urbanized contexts, in places where there are high real estate costs, in places where education expenses are high. This is partly the story of South Korea, which is the lowest fertility rate of any country in the world, Annika. You know, it's partly because, you know, the costs of raising the next generation are very high. And the opportunity costs for women of, like, you know, stepping away from full-time work are extremely high as well. So yes, the financial piece is part and parcel of why I think we're seeing fertility fall in some places, in some regions of the world, in dramatic ways, especially. But there's also just a cultural shift unfolding too, where I think more and more young adults are embracing what I call the Midas mindset. And it's all about education, work, and kind of building your own brand, living your own life, staying free of the encumbrances of a spouse, and especially children. Even we're hearing too, I was at an event in Nashville, Tennessee, and hearing about young adults are afraid of having kids. You know, it's going to be so much of a strain for the women. It's going to be, you know, pregnancy is terrible and giving birth is horrible. So, you know, there's a big cultural shift that's kind of unfolding, and it's going to leave a lot of people heading into midlife and later life, either without a spouse or without children.
So there's one kind of scenario, and I'm curious as a demographer how you feel about it. But at least in principle, if you are one of the, you know, one in three people my age who doesn't get married, you don't get married, you don't have kids, you don't pass on the same ideology that prevented you from having kids to the next generation, is it possible that we'll experience like a demographic funnel that will then go out? Or is there some other way in which these kind of values move from generation to generation?
Well, I think the big question is whether or not, you know, more religious and conservative adults today who do tend to marry and have kids in larger numbers will transmit their worldview to the next generation. And if they do that, then they would kind of enjoy some kind of longer term demographic and cultural kind of benefit for their way of life. You know, up to now, though, we've seen, you know, plenty of young adults who've been raised in conservative and or religious homes, you know, gravitate towards a more progressive or secular position. And so we don't see any kind of, you know, major shift towards religion or towards a more familistic way of life, you know, unfolding yet. But the one exception to all that, right, is in the Jewish community. I grew up in Northeast, right, and plenty of friends and acquaintances who were Reform, conservative, and secular Jews. But now as I kind of navigate, when I go back home, you know, the Jewish world in the Northeast is much more dominated by Orthodox and ultra-Orthodox Jews.
Yeah.
In part because they've married in higher numbers, they've had kids in larger numbers, they've done a better job of keeping kids in their own traditions. So I think that experience is interesting. And, you know, I think that Catholics and Protestants who would like to kind of have greater success with retaining their kids might want to take some lessons from the Jewish community there.
Yeah, that is really interesting. Well, yeah, especially being one half secular Jew, I've definitely seen some of that play out. And also post October 7, a lot of my Jewish friends became radically more religious, including pretty secular ones, which was also...
That's interesting, yeah.
Yeah, so yeah.
You see how that plays out demographically.
Yeah, so, actually yeah. That will be an interesting. So I know that you're just about out of time, but to close us out here, I mean, we've sort of skirted around a little bit this idea that life is fundamentally kind of about a me first approach and what's going to bring me immediate happiness.
Exactly. Right.
And you've talked a lot in your book about the ways in which that's really detrimental towards marriage. Is marriage a sentence for never being able to put yourself first? And for self-care not existing? And if so, is that good or bad?
No, I mean, of course not. I mean, obviously, you know, people who are like, you know, reasonably happily married and who are thoughtful and considerate of their spouses make time for, you know, their spouse to do, you know, fun things. And whether it's a getaway with the girls, you know, for a weekend or whatever it might be, you know, a skiing trip with friends in Colorado, or a religious retreat for that matter too, for people who are more religious, you know, so that's, but it is the case. You've got less free time for yourself. And I interviewed a be a woman here in Virginia. And she's talking about when she was unmarried and childless, she had more time for blogs. She had more time, you know, for restaurants and, you know, any number of other kinds of things you could imagine, you know, the sort of fun, freewheeling 20s phase of her life. But she's married with kids, and she talks about, you know, she's got toddlers, and there's more mess, and there's more crying, and there's more stress, and, you know, it's, but, you know, from her perspective, her life is much more fulfilling than it was before she had a spouse and children. And she's a lot less lonely than she was as a 20-something single woman, you know. And so as she kind of nets it all out from her perspective, you know, there's no question that she is a happier woman, you know, for all of this. Now, can, from a sociological position, though, the bigger question is, well, who is happiest among women, say, for instance, 1855? And what I can say is, looking at just at the general social survey in front of me right here, that about 40% of married moms are very happy, compared to just 22% of women who are single with no kids. And then when it comes to who's not happy, basically, 25% of single and without kids are not happy, and only 13% of women who are married with kids are not happy. So despite what you might read in the New York Times, what you might read in the Washington Post last week, for instance, any number of mainstream media, you know, outlets who have been kind of depicting marriage often in a very negative light, you know, who have been kind of leading us to think that, to just quote one New York Times writer recently, she said, "Married motherhood in America is a game no one wins."
Wow.
So maybe that was true for her, and she lives in Brooklyn. So who knows? There's so many writers in Brooklyn. I don't know what the issue is there in Brooklyn. Anyways,
clearly not one of the Orthodox Jewish women.
Well, I guess not. Who knows? I'm just saying there's so many writers writing from Brooklyn complaining about marriage and motherhood. But again, across the U.S., married moms are nearly twice as likely to say they're very happy with their lives compared to a single childless woman, and they're about half as likely to say that they're not too happy with their lives compared to single and childless women. So for most women, and then for most men as well, marriage and parenthood are sources of enormous meaning and purpose and direction. And again, most, but not all of the time, happiness.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for your time, Dr. Wilcox. This has been a real pleasure. Your book will be linked in the show notes. Everyone should check it out. It's in the imperative, get married. I'm doing my best. I'm trying. I'll do my best. But anyway, thank you so much. Yeah. This has been really great.
Okay. Thanks, Annika. I appreciate the time.
Well, there you have it, Madisonians. Dr. Brad Wilcox on his new book, Get Married. It's linked in the show notes. There's tons of stuff in it that didn't come up in this interview, including, if you're a nerd like me, many more statistics, as well as a lot of individual stories. So I'd absolutely encourage you to give it a read. If you enjoyed this episode, first of all, you can leave us a rating or review, which we do always very much appreciate. But you might also be interested in learning more about the James Madison Program, everything that we do here on Princeton's campus. And you can do that at our website, jmp.princeton.edu. Among other things, you can sign up for a mailing list. You can check out the recordings of all the previous lectures that we've hosted here at Princeton and see our schedule of upcoming events and other ways to get involved. You can also find us on social media, on Twitter at Madison Program, as well as on Instagram and Facebook. Again, thanks so much for tuning in, and I can't wait to see you next time here on Madison's Notes.